WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Selma, Alabama holds an important place in the civil rights movement. In March 1965, on a day now remembered as Bloody Sunday, men and women marching from Selma for voting rights were attacked by state troopers and white posses. The Voting Rights Act was passed in part in response to this tragedy. At the time, my guest J.L. Chestnut was a lawyer in Selma, working with the NAACP. In 1958, Chestnut had become Selma's first and only black lawyer. He defended activists during the civil rights movement, and since then he's been involved in what he describes as the longer march, turning the victories of the civil rights movement into grassroots change. He founded a law firm in Selma that is now the largest black law firm in Alabama. Chestnut has written an autobiography, Black in Selma. It's co-authored with Julia Cass, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. In his book, Chestnut writes about growing up in Selma in the years before the Civil Rights Act. To help him get ahead in the world, his mother had him use a cream to lighten his skin.
I never agreed with that. I went along. My mother's a very strong woman, and she felt that black people could not help anybody. They needed all the help they could get in Selma in the South when I was growing up in the 40s. And so she cultivated white people, and she noticed and told me that if you look about you, all of the prominent black people are light-skinned. The postman, the doctor, the better-known preachers, those who pass at the larger churches. And so she would use this skin lightening as to help her only child get ahead. That is the way she saw things. I never really believed in it, but she's such a strong woman, you go along with her.
What was in the cream, by the way, do you know?
I don't know, but it worked because I'm brown and I turned kind of reddish, to her absolute delight.
So it really changed the color of your skin?
It really did.
Huh. Do you regret that?
Well, I think it makes you think about a nation that would cause people to develop so much self-hatred that you could really have a product on the market commercially successful to try and change one's appearance. And then I'm really sad that my mother would have to stoop to that to try to, in her view, to get her son ahead in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Mm-hmm. You went to law school at Howard University, and then you returned to Selma, Alabama. Why did you go back home?
Well, Martin Luther King Jr., who's 1 year older than I am, had, with Rosa Parks, started virtually a revolution in Montgomery, which is just 50 miles east of Selma. And other things were developing in Selma and in the South, which indicated to me that the action likely to come would come in the South rather than in Harlem or in the North. Now, I did not anticipate any action on the scale as the civil rights movement. We had some very modest goals in mind. If you remember the Montgomery bus boycott, Martin and the group were not asking for integrated buses. They were just asking for the right to sit from the back up halfway and have whites sit from the front halfway. They were not even seeking integration of the buses because that was almost fantasy land back there. So I didn't anticipate anything like what did happen.
My guest is J.L. Chestnut, and he has written an autobiography called Black in Selma, Politics and Power in a Small American Town. When you returned to Selma as a lawyer, what kind of cases did you get, being the first black lawyer in Selma?
Yeah, let me give you some flavor of what was going on there. There were only 150 blacks registered to vote out of a pool of about 15,000. Not one black, not one in the entire state of Alabama had ever served on a jury. No blacks had jobs downtown except as delivery people or janitors. And a black person could literally lose his or her life for not yielding a sidewalk or saying sir or ma'am to a white person. Fear was everywhere. It engulfed Selma and it engulfed the South. Now, that is the the Selma, the South that I went back to practice law. And the white lawyers there were not only the rulers of the town, they were sophisticated, the country club sophisticates and all of that. They didn't associate with ordinary white people. And they certainly didn't want any parts of some black coming in talking about. He was a lawyer in the Dallas County Bar Association. Selma is the county seat of Dallas. Promptly passed a resolution and took it to each bank and asking the banks not to lend me any money so that I could open an office. And I had no intentions of trying to borrow any money in any event because I didn't have any collateral. But everybody was hostile, the judge, the officers of the court, the jury, because these seemed to be the same white males all serving in every case. And I had to ask myself many, many times whether or not my client really would be better off with a white lawyer, one who didn't know anything, didn't know as much as I did.
You make an interesting point in your book. You say that, we know when you started as a lawyer, there was no Voting Rights Act, there was no Civil Rights Act. So a lot of injustices couldn't be taken to court.
What we hoped to do was to make new law. We didn't expect to win at that level. The NAACP at that point were financing a lot of criminal cases which were pregnant with the possibility of establishing some of the laws we have on the books now, the Miranda thing where the police have to read you your rights and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the South was fertile territory for that because just being black in the South made one vulnerable to the police and all of their excesses, and many of them were untrained and in their relationships with black, unrestrained. So we were trying to get cases to the United States Supreme Court that would deal with whether a confession was voluntary. Eventually we did and changed the law on that subject. A lot of things which are now the law came about through some of our efforts, and the court, just with the passage of time, got where we were trying to push them way back in, 1958, 1960.
You said that you didn't feel completely part of the black world as a lawyer in Selma, and that you felt alienated from the gossip and endless conversations about sex and women, and that nobody really wanted to organize or take action.
Well, that's right, but you have to remember, in the Selma of that day, it could easily cost you your life. Many people were killed for talking politics or talking about changing the social order. When I went back to Selma, I didn't expect to become a part of the white world. I had no intentions or desire to become a part of that world. What I didn't anticipate is that I wouldn't be quite a part of the black world either. Now, these were my friends. I went to school with them. I was born there in Selma. And they loved to kid around with me, but it was a kind of superficial. It was something phony about it because everybody was scared to death that I would bring up something about voting or about the law. And black people had to be very careful because you never knew what black would go back downtown and tell white people of power that this black said that or said that. And so people were very nervous around me. And a lot of times I'd come in a place and all conversation would stop or some people would get up and leave. And there I was, isolated, alone, in a little town of 20,000, 28,000 people, the town in which I was born.
Were people worried also that because you were a lawyer and a representative of the law that you not turn someone in exactly, but that maybe you'd inform on someone or report on someone? Was there that fear, too?
No, it wasn't that. My reputation in Selma was clear that I had been fighting the police almost literally since I was 7 years old. They knew there was no way I would turn anybody into the police. I might turn the police into somebody.
What was your reaction as a, quote, local when Martin Luther King came to organize in Selma in 1965?
Well, I had been somewhat ambivalent about all of the civil rights leaders. I felt that what they were saying was directed more at the masses than at me. After all, I had 2 degrees, too, and I was educated. And Martin had views which ran counter to everything I'd learned in law school. For an example, he insisted that he had a high moral right to disobey an unjust law. And he would make the determination when the law was unjust. That is not what I learned in law school. That wasn't what I believed in. I felt that you go to court to get a law declared unconstitutional. I wasn't quite sure about all this unjust business. That's not the terminology that lawyers use. In addition to that, Martin was always trying to get me to give up my weapon and calling me a man of little faith. And I was telling him that you go ahead and preach to the masses, but I'm not paying you any attention. I'm going to keep my weapon because it can bark here and bite way down the street. And Martin would laugh. But I knew that his presence in Selma meant that more people like my mother, middle-class blacks, would become involved. That Martin's presence gave a legitimacy to the movement that it otherwise would not have. Also, as long as he was involved, important and powerful white people in Washington would be watching. So he meant everything to the movement.
Did you ever get more comfortable with civil disobedience as a tactic for civil rights?
I was finally convinced that Martin was correct and the people who were paying me were incorrect. It is not generally known, but you take Bloody Sunday. That started out of a situation where a young man, Jimmie Lee Jackson, was shot dead by a state trooper. People were so frustrated and all that, they came up with the grotesque idea of just taking Jimmie's body and marching 50 miles to Montgomery and putting the body on George Wallace's desk. And, of course, that was not done, but it was agreed to make the march to Montgomery. And Martin was not involved in that first march, but he came on, I think, the day following in that march. But what is not generally known is while they were putting the people in the streets, they were not paying for that. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York was financing that. And they were a legalistic organization. That's who I work for. Their view was that you take two or three obviously qualified people, send them down to get registered, and when they are turned down, you go into court, you got a perfect case. Martin was repudiating all that by sending 500 people down because he said he wanted to win in the court of public opinion. He was not interested just in adding a few more votes to the voting rolls in Selma. So I eventually came around to the point of view that he was correct and my bosses were not.
Well, Bloody Sunday on March 7th, 1965, happened during a march from Selma to Montgomery to petition George Wallace for the right to vote. The march was broken up violently by state troopers. Would you share some of your memories of that day?
Well, I had come over from Mississippi, and I wasn't sure that there would be a march. Martin was in Atlanta preaching at his father's church, and some people in Martin's organization did not think well of a march. They didn't think it was worth risking Martin. But I think Andy Young called him in Atlanta and persuaded him that there would be a march with or without him. And Martin then okayed the march. I had gone across the river earlier, across the bridge, because they would not let lawyers march. You know, you had enough foot soldiers. What we didn't have was enough lawyers. And it didn't make sense to have lawyers in jail. So I had gone across the river earlier, not knowing whether there would be a march, and to get to a telephone, because once a march started, you would have the FBI, the press, and everybody fighting over the one telephone. So I went over there early to tie it up in case there would be a march. And I'd have to describe to the NAACP what was happening because they were paying the bill. And I was over there tying up the telephone, and I looked up toward the bridge, and there was John Lewis, who's now Congressman John Lewis from Georgia, Atlanta. And this group of marchers coming toward this great line of state troopers and possemen. and I began to describe the scene over the telephone to New York. And then John and the group came face to face with the troopers. And I heard some voice, a state trooper, who said that, stop, this will be as far as you will be permitted to go. Turn around and go back to your churches. And then John and the others began to kneel and pray. And then I heard something that sounded like a tear gas canister hit the pavement. And then there was smoke, bedlam, confusion, blood, tears, cries, and there were these big, hefty possumen swinging billy clubs the size of baseball bats and coming down across the heads of women and children. My eyes were hurting, my head was hurting, and New York was screaming over the telephone, what's going on, what's going on? And I tried to pull some women back out of the street, and it was just awful. It was one of the lowest days of my life. At that day, I lost all faith in America. I lost all faith in white people. I said, my God, black people will never be citizens. We will never be what we ought to be in this land. And what is this? I have gone to Howard University. I'm a lawyer, an officer in the white man's court. And here these people are trampling on my folk in the streets, blood everywhere. And they're trampling on the Constitution, and nobody does anything about it because these people are black. And I was just almost in tears. And 2 days later, I had to revise and make a new assessment because white people and black people came from all over this nation that watched it on television, and they were thoroughly upset at what they saw. You know, it's easy to send a check down from New York and say, I'm with you. It's something altogether different to come down and lock hands with a black person and say, I'm ready to go to jail. I'm ready to die if necessary. And I saw hundreds and hundreds of people come from all over this land to join with us in this little town of my birth. And I had to look and reassess all over again. And my faith in this nation, my faith in the human race was restored.
When the Voting Rights Act was actually passed, what were the immediate effects in Selma?
The immediate effect was that within a six-week span, we went from about 200 registered voters to 9,000. I don't know whether there has been a leap of such proportions in the history of the human race. People who could not vote had no voice in their government in a matter of 6 weeks became very important players. It is somewhat reminiscent of what has just transpired in Eastern Europe. But we saw immediate impact of that in the courtroom. Blacks began to show up on juries. White politicians had to temper what they said about blacks. And some blacks began to feel that they could run for office. Where there had been hopelessness, we now had hope. Where we felt, I certainly felt, that all we could really hope for was to make some adjustments around the edges in the economic sphere, or maybe get enough votes to get the white policeman out of Black Summer. I saw now that we could do much more than that, that blacks could really sit on governments and pass laws that affected both black and white people. America began to develop some meaning for me.
What are some of the difficulties of, in a way, being part of the establishment now rather than being outside of it?
It is far more difficult to advise a school board than it is to attack it. It's easy to attack it. But when you got to raise the money, and when you have to find the teachers, and you have to comply with the state law, all of that's infinitely more difficult to do than just standing and being a gadfly and a critic on the outside. And all of a sudden, after the Voting Rights Act and blacks were voting, and see, I come from what is called a black belt in Alabama. This is where the large slave plantations were. That's why most of these counties are 60% and 70% black, and they are as racially polarized as any in South Africa, because whites knew that once blacks got the votes, blacks would take them over. And blacks have taken over county governments, county school boards. And because we were there fighting with them, they retained our law firm. And we had to go from outside protesters to inside establishment people. And it hasn't been easy.
I'd like to get back now to something you said earlier when we were talking about Martin Luther King. You said that one of the things he wanted you to do was to give up your weapon.
Yes.
And that you were unwilling to do that. It was a gun.
That's right.
You write that you actually gave up your gun the night Martin Luther King was assassinated.
I did. I threw it in the river.
Oh, why?
Well, that was my deep feeling over Martin. I stayed down there on that river under the same bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, crying for about 30 minutes and reflected on it, that my carrying a weapon certainly had not saved Martin. It didn't save Jimmie Lee Jackson. I couldn't think of anything it had done for me, really. And I'd seen John Lewis stare down a whole regiment of state troopers and sheriffs, and he had no weapon. And the things that had been brought about, the changes that had occurred in settlement in the South, had not come at the end of any gun. So it's a tribute to my friend who'd given his life in Memphis. I threw it away and watched it sink in the river, and I felt better.
Had you ever used it? What did you want it to do for you when you had the gun?
Oh, just for self-protection. I was not going to attack anybody, but if they came to get me, I would be ready. You know, Martin Luther King was preoccupied with death, foreboding all the time. And he said more than once that they're going to come for us, each one of us, and we won't be back. And I believed him. But the only difference is I had a weapon and I had intended to take some with me.
Now that your memoir is completed, your autobiography, and you can see your life compressed between the covers of a book, has it led you to think about anything that you haven't thought about before, or see your life in a different context than you'd seen it before?
Well, when you are battling and going from one war to the next, so to speak, you really don't have any sense of the whole. And this book has caused me to see the many, many barriers that have fallen in the last 30 years that I had never really given any thought to. I am really astounded at the progress we have made, but I'm even more astounded at the progress we haven't made. It's like talking to white people in Selma who are always telling me, said, look how far you've come. In no time at all. And I'm always saying, that's true, but look how far we have to go. I guess it's the old argument about whether the glass is half full or half empty with water. And it depends on your vantage point. But I've had a chance to view for the first time because of this book. I've had a chance to look back over 30 years. And I'm not displeased with what I see.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
My guest has been J.L. Chestnut. His new autobiography is Black in Selma, Politics and Power in a Small American Town. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.